Clayton. John Clayton.
And now, I'm done with my segment.
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Coors Light. Made to chill.
We're talking football with the professor, John Clayton. If you guys have questions for John, you can text those in right now to 710-710, the Busy Hard Seltzer text line. We'll try to get to as many of your questions as we can before we let him go. Hello, John.
Hello. You keeping Jim Moore upright right now? Because I know he's depressed.
Why is he depressed? Oh, Minshew?
Minshew, yeah.
Is he at, now, let's tell people what you're talking about, John. Minshew.
Okay, so Gardner Minshew, back on October 11th, apparently to not his knowledge and the team's knowledge, ended up fracturing his thumb in multiple places. Now, how they didn't understand that and how he didn't feel that, you don't know. But you notice his performance went down the last 2 weeks. I mean, he completed, 51% of his passes in the game on Sunday. And so he was not performing at Gardner Minshew-type level. When they're in the bye week right now, and I guess they checked the thumb and they found out his right thumb is fractured in many places, and they don't know what that means as far as his timetable coming back. I mean, he was able to play with it. I mean, you'd have to think the league's going to investigate this a little bit to say, did you know that this thumb was fractured? But, of course, remember a couple years ago when Richard Sherman had some kind of an injury and that came out and you found out about it later, and it's like, whoa. So they investigate it, but if you don't miss practice, you don't have to worry about it as much, and Minshew did not miss practice. He gutted through it. But right now, there's a chance that he could be out for a couple weeks.
Yeah, John, if that's the case, you know who's going to be playing? It's Jake Luton.
I know.
From Oregon State.
Well, it's either going to be Jake Luton.
I thought it was Glennon.
Or Mike Glennon, one of the two.
Hmm.
Team decision.
Okay. Wouldn't you rather see Luton than Glennon?
I'd rather not watch the game.
Oh.
I mean, do you think I want to watch a team right now that's given six straight games over 30 points a game, and if they do it again this weekend, which is likely, that'll be an NFL record of seven.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I want to watch that.
Yeah, I don't know if they're playing this weekend or not.
No, they're not. They're playing next week.
Yeah.
They're on a bye week.
John, we heard a couple of clips from your interview with John Lynch. Pretty good. I love that guy.
And, yeah, I did.
Yeah, to tell us a couple of the things that stood out to you when you had your conversation with him.
Well, I mean, I think the one thing that just his football observation, as a safety, it was an in-the-box safety watching the running game and talking about the evolution of the Shanahan running offense and how the game has changed. And it's like what I think is interesting is he said now, it used to be a game. And when you played it, Dave, I mean, I know it was the TVs were black and white. The phones were rotary and all that different stuff.
Leather helmets.
Clayton,
leather
helmets. What? You are just full of P&V today.
I appreciate that.
All right.
Yeah,
go ahead.
But, I appreciate that.
But also it's like the game was played inside the numbers. All and right. So now with the motions that are there with all the different type of running plays to the outside and outside options and all those different things, you use up every blade of grass, and it forces defenses to now have to stretch the field more to try to do it. That's why guys like Buda Baker, Jamal Adams, fast linebackers, you want more speed, and so that has now become a big part of this game. And so I thought that was interesting, still trying to figure out how the daily events are when you're going through the team. It's one of the most injured in the National Football League. Week to week, you don't know if you've got how many receivers, how many running backs, how many defensive backs, who you have on the defensive line. I thought that was fascinating. And then, just how he looks at the game right now, because it's, certainly more offense than he's ever seen, and how that the defenses eventually have to try to adjust.
Well, John, I think this is a good question from the 425. Will the 49ers secondary be exposed this week? When you consider they've got backups at both safety spots, backup at Richard Sherman's spot there, I'm not sure what they're doing at right cornerback, but it seems like it could be a big night for Russell.
Yeah, the two safeties don't play. Now you're looking at Emmanuel Mosley being the only true starter. I know Arkello Witherspoon was a starter last year, but he was so bad that Mosley, an undrafted player from a couple years ago, ended up overtaking him. And Mosley's not bad. I mean, Jason Verrett has done a nice job, so he'll be out there. And so that'll be their three cornerback group if there's not going to be any Richard Sherman. But again, without the safeties, that's going to make it tough. Now, again, maybe from the Seahawks standpoint, not knowing who's going to be there at running back, that kind of makes it maybe a little bit bit uncertain. But no, I think, I mean, how can it not? Because, you know, the team, you know, does get more pressure on the quarterback than Seattle, but how much more pressure? And, you know, how's that going to be? But, you know, we've watched it now in so many different instances, and we've seen it in so many Seahawks games. If you're going to be down at cornerback, you saw it in Minnesota, Dallas, Atlanta, I mean, you're going to have big problems. And right now, if they're going to be down three-fourths of their secondary, that's not good.
John, and again, if you guys have questions for John Clayton, you can text those into 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. It, as far as what this team does with the running game, we played that clip that you had with the GM earlier, and he was talking about it being the same thing they've done for years ago, that they just dress it up. Mm-hmm. He said, I think we put some lipstick on it.
Lipstick, yeah.
It was the illusion of complexity,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
I thought was an interesting phrase there. What does that mean when you see that? Does it look more confusing to you, or do you look at it and go, yeah, that's basically what's always been done?
Yeah, and I'll need a little bit of help on this from Dave. But, you know, basically, I mean, wasn't Mike Shanahan, I mean, your favorite coach, he basically had five running plays. Is that the right number, five?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so it's,
I mean,
about
they're
five.
All pretty basic.
Yeah, and what they do is that they come at it, you know, different ways, different type of, you know, ways that they run it, and different type of ways that they block it. And now the illusion of complexity is even more so, because now you add motion to this. And so you have basically five running plays that they use, but you never know which one you're going to get. And that's where the play calling for both Mike and also Kyle is so distinct, because you're always in a guessing game.
Well, and I'd say this too, and here's the problem with a lot of times with motion and doing all those tricky things like putting the lipstick on it, or, you know, dressing it up or whatever, is that guys make mistakes. And so you have more moving parts, which means you're more likely to get an offsides penalty, or, you know, an illegal motion or whatever. And that's what makes me admire Kyle Shanahan so much, is because they are so well coached. You know, and you saw, and I know a lot of it's because of injury, but, John, there's 11 guys that have carried the ball. They've run some fly sweeps and things like that, but it just seems like, just like his dad, you know, that you plug in the next player, the next running back, and they're able to execute. And they're pretty, you know, some of the stuff, the motion, all that stuff, that's sort of new age. But when the play snaps and the blocking and all that, it's good old-fashioned football, and that's what I love about it.
Yeah, and that's going to be the challenge. And, you know, and I know that there's been more copying of his running offense. And, again, we can also say Sean McVay, but guess what? Where did Sean McVay learn that running offense? He learned it from Kyle when they're together in Washington, mm-hmm. on the Washington football team. So, no, I think that's the fascinating thing. And, you know, you look at it and you say, okay, colleges now have so many creative things that they're doing, you know, spread offenses, four receiver sets, five receiver sets, all those different things, and they find a way to get the running back going in certain directions. But really, when you think about it, you know, Kyle and Mike Shanahan have been so far ahead of the game that they have the best running system, and they've had it now for, what, 3 decades?
Yeah, it's been a long time, John. NBC Sports back in Boston, NBCSports.com. Stephon Gilmore, they've got five landing spots for Gilmore: Seattle, Tennessee, Tampa Bay, geez. New Orleans, and Detroit. John, I think I caught your sentiment there. Seattle doesn't have anything left to trade
for
them, do they?
No, they don't have anything left to trade, and
they
have no cap room.
Room under the cap?
Yeah.
Well, can't they make it work anyway, Professor?
What's that?
Can't they make it work anyway?
No, not that kind of contract. Oh. Absolutely not.
How much
not.
Is he making?
What is it like? He's, I think, 14. No, he's about $16 million a year.
Didn't they, John? They could use
a
guy
a
like
raise,
that.
Though, yeah, John? They did.
What
year.
Was that?
They gave
they
him
could
a raise,
use a guy.
Didn't they?
Well, they have two guys. I mean, you know, Quentin Dunbar, who was a near Pro Bowl level, and they've got Shaquille Griffin, who went to the Pro Bowl. And so it's like they can't fit it in. I hate it when people study, you know, put this thing out, and they, and again, you didn't. It's like they did, and it's so stupid.
Yeah, but what about people that copy it and just say it over when they know it's a dumb thing to say?
Mm-hmm.
Like Jim. Well, the defense needs help, John. I'm here to help.
Yeah, okay.
You got any money? I do. Yeah. Not a whole
I mean,
lot,
they
got
to bail themselves out, because they still have over $2 million they have to, you know, clear to get the Dunbar contract in. Now, technically, he's exempt right now because, you know, he and B.J. Finney are going through the protocol. And so at some point, those contracts are going to fit in. But right now, it's like, come on. You know, it's like, you know, in New Orleans, I mean, that's a tough situation. And it's like, okay, so they're going to trade for for Stephon Gilmore, you know, when they have Jackrabbit, Janoris Jenkins, and they have Marcus Lattimore, who they have to find a way to get a long-term deal to, and it's going to cost them like $17 million. I mean, come on.
What do you think it would take to get Gilmore, though? I mean, let's just say that you have money under the – I mean, I'm not talking about Seattle, but would it take a first-rounder, second-rounder, fourth-rounder?
You know, what they might do is take a second and a fifth or something like that. But, you know, this team, you know, it only has five draft choices left, and they don't have the cap room. Doesn't work.
John, we played a cut from Pete Carroll talking about the Dunlap deal and saying, hey, John Schneider's always out there. He's in the middle of it. If somebody's available, we're looking at him. He says they've looked at a lot of other positions as well. What do you think is the most pressing? If they make another move or two before the trade deadline, do you see them going defensive line again? Do you see them going running back, perhaps cornerback? If Shaq's not going to be healthy, Dunbar's been dealing with injuries, maybe they address that depth. What do you think?
I think it'd be more defensive end than it is anything else, because they're deep on the offensive line, you know, deep enough that they could take a BJ Finney and trade him. You know, they're deep at tight end. I mean, you know, could be, you know, a wide receiver, but I tend to doubt it. You know, it's like, and running back, I mean, you know, maybe if they're worried a little bit about the injuries, maybe that could be a consideration. You know, certainly the linebacking core is so deep right now that they don't have Michael Kendricks on the roster. They, you know, they did get Ray Armstrong out there. Safety, I mean, they're fine there because of Ryan Neal coming off the bench. Cornerback, I mean, they need to, you know, get more challenges to get Trey Flowers to play better. But overall, it's like you look at it and you say they're in pretty good shape.
Hey, John, Julian Edelman's going to miss some time, it looks like. And what do you think's going on there? We saw, you know, I was telling Jake this earlier, and he agreed, Jake Heaps, that some of those throws by Cam Newton were some of the worst passes I've seen in the NFL.
Yeah.
And they tailed down.
Ever?
Yes, they were awful.
Would it be Tim Tebow-esque?
Could be.
Yeah.
Charlie Whitehurst was a member of this team for a while. You got a good look at
him. Whitehurst had some bad ones. But anyway, Edelman out. I mean, if he's going to be out, they don't have much in the way of receivers. And then, boy, you talk about a challenging year. Where do you think Belichick's going to go with this? I mean, do you think he's going to maybe start unloading guys? You mentioned Stephon Gilmore, you know, or is it he's just going to try to battle through this, the quarterback thing? It's very, very odd what's going on there. And it seems like Tom Brady is winning the battle.
No doubt. Oh, yeah. No question he's winning the battle. And so, because, they're adding talent and the Patriots are losing talent. Again, it's depending on what you want to call Antonio Brown, which, of course, I still shake my head and say, okay, so now what's the first little issue? Well, we got to get Antonio Brown on the field if he's going to be able to get off suspension. And so we're going to go to a four-receiver offense and we're going to, you know, shut down Rob Gronkowski and we're going to shut down Cameron Brate. Beautiful. But, I think that they're just kind of falling apart. And I think they realize if they lose to the Buffalo Bills in Buffalo on Sunday, they're pretty much done, because you look at Buffalo in the worst case scenario, they're going to come back and win 10, and then you have the Patriots with five losses and a loss in Buffalo. I mean, one more loss and it's doomsday for them. And then the problem is, the trade deadline is Tuesday, so it's not like they can unload players after that. They've got plenty of cap room this year, plenty of cap room next year, and they got all those guys coming back off the opt-outs, the eight opt-outs that they have. So it looks like they'll close the door in week eight and week nine, and then wait till next year.
Professor, what do you think the Seahawks record is going to be in the next four games? They've got San Francisco at Buffalo, at the Rams, and Arizona at CenturyLink Field. Do you think 3-1, 4-0, 2-2?
I think maybe 2-2, maybe. If they can win the San Francisco game, then I think it can be 3-1. I mean, I think the Buffalo game's going to be tough, the Rams game, but I think they'll come back and win the second Arizona game. So those are the ones that are going to be in flux. Now, again, if they can pull out a win, I mean, it's more important to win the division games. And so when you look at that, I mean, they need to get the Arizona game. If they can go 3-1 in the division games, then they're in golden shape. Because, again, this is going to be a mad race, because you've got every team in this division winning with a winning record.
What happened to Don Terry Poe? This guy was a good player at one point and seemed like he was going to be a star, and they just released him in Dallas. Jerry Jones' statement says, when you're 30 pounds overweight and you're not doing anything about what's keeping you from performing well on the field, there's no reason to get into other stuff. What I mean, was he a guy that was just unhappy being out there like a lot of people seem to be, or is he just – not is he not a hard worker?
You know,
what happened?
I'll be surprised that there was not more of this. Because, you figured that the players were left on their own to train because there was no off-season program. And guys, and apparently Poe came in out of shape and never got in shape. Because, I mean, this is one of the rare years, and we haven't seen this since 2011, that guys had to almost go to training camp to get in shape if they didn't train hard in the off-season. Now, fortunately, 99% of the players trained hard enough that you didn't hear any too many tales of this. But I mean, to say that Don Terry Poe was Don Terry fat, like Jerry Jones is saying, is, that says a lot. But it also shows how it affected his game. Pro Football Focus rated him the worst defensive tackle in football. And I guess when you're 30 pounds heavier, you can see that happening. I mean, we watched good play last year by DJ Fluker, but also, I mean, he admitted that his weight was 44% body fat last year. And so you didn't see it in the initial hits, but you could see it getting to the second level. That was a struggle. But I think, Poe, and, again, he can rip Poe, but I think you have to rip Jerry Jones on this, because he spent $18 million a year on five players on defense, and they didn't work out. I mean, remember, they signed Ha-Ha Clinton Dix. Okay, they cut him. They signed Gerald McCoy. They cut him. In the case of McCoy, in the case of Poe, I mean, they were making over $5 million a year. Daryl Worley, the cornerback, making a one-year $3 million deals. They got rid of him. They gave Everson Griffin one-year $6 million. I mean, that's $18 million a year. And there was one, I mean, Poe and McCoy got two multi-year deals, but what a disaster. I mean, he tried to fix the defense, and he failed.
John, looks like we're not going to see Christian McCaffrey again tonight, huh?
Nope.
Yeah. What's the sentiment there? I mean, they signed him to this huge deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously he's injured, but still.
High ankle sprain.
Frustrating.
High ankle sprain, and that's one that was initially going to be bad. So you figure it's going to be 4 to 6 weeks. So my guess is he has a chance to play in the next game, but it's just not ready this week. And again, you can't speed up those high ankle sprains, particularly when they're bad ones. You've had them. You know them.
Yeah, didn't they used to call it a broken leg?
It was a broken leg,
like,
yeah, back in the Jack Lambert days and all that stuff. It's like, because, again, you have all those little small bones, and those bones separate, and that's why they used to call it a broken leg.
Well, Professor, who wins the game tonight? Carolina's favored by 1.5.
Probably Carolina. I mean, Atlanta just seems to be in such a funk, and their cornerback play is now the worst in football, particularly on third downs. Somehow, some way, they haven't got the word that Olivier Oliver is terrible. I mean, so it's like, they haven't got that word yet. A.J. Terrell looks promising, but he's been up and down, had the COVIDs for a week or two, and he had a bad game last week. But yeah, I think he's got some good potential, but it's just not there yet. And the pass rush has been minimal.
Hey, John, back to the Cowboys for a moment. What do you think they do at the quarterback spot? They've got Ben DiNucci, and he's not sure if he's going to start or not against the Eagles. But reading a story, Dak Prescott had some great words of advice for him. But ultimately, do you see them going with him if Dalton is going to be out for any length of time, or do you see him trying to bring somebody in?
I don't know. They got to figure that out next week. But it's too late to do something this week,
right?
Because nobody can get on the field until like Tuesday or Wednesday, and so. And you have to figure that the way that Andy Dalton was hit, that's going to be a multiple week concussion. Now, he hasn't been able to practice all week, and nobody expected him to be able to do it. But it could be. Can you imagine Ben DiNucci, who, again, as I mentioned yesterday, I think he's a barber that I had many years ago, maybe in a Fast Clips or something like that. But you have Ben DiNucci and Garrett Gilbert.
Professor, I'm picturing the 1972 Miami Dolphins just putting their hands together and thinking, oh boy, here we go. The last unbeaten team, where they're getting their champagne ready down there in Miami. You think Pittsburgh's going to go down this week at Baltimore?
Well, I don't know. It's like, are they still going to do that with the passing of Don Shula? I kind of wonder about that, because we lost a great one when he passed away in the past year. But, yeah, I think that the remaining players might be still willing to do that, and certainly probably more so this year than maybe in future years, just in honor of Don and what he meant. But, it's like this is going to be a fascinating game, because I think Pittsburgh, even though they're 3.5-point underdogs, have a chance to win just because they've got a good defense. They've got Ben Roethlisberger. And, you know, right now, you know, Lamar Jackson and that Baltimore offense isn't playing up to the level it was last year. Now, what's also scary for Pittsburgh is that the defense is better, and now you got Calais Campbell and Unique Ndakwe back together again, and that could be painful.
John, we appreciate it. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, if you missed any of today's cold, hard facts, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill, download the podcast at 710sports.com. Coming up, we'll check in with Paul Moyer. Are the Seahawks being too conservative with their cornerbacks? We'll see what he's got to say about that. That's coming up next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Coming up at 5 o'clock, our player spotlight will feature Seahawks kicker Jason Meyer. So stay tuned for that. Again, coming up at 5 o'clock, we'll catch up with Paul Moyer here in just a couple of moments. We always look forward to this conversation. And I'll be curious to see what he says about how the cornerbacks are playing, because there's frustration with the cushion they're giving, to say the least, right? And I was telling you, Dave, I can't remember if it was like a 3rd and 6 or a 3rd and 7, somewhere around there. And it looked like Trey Flowers was giving the guy like 12 yards of cushion. And I'm going, what are you going? Well, we got Paul here. We'll see what Paul says.
Yeah, ask Paul, not me.
Yeah, we'll see what our buddy Paul Moyer, who's with us now. Hello, Paul.
Hello there. How's everybody doing?
We're good. We were just talking defense, as we have been for the majority of the season. And I wanted to talk to you about the cornerback specifically, because we've gotten people that have texted in and hit me on Twitter and different things about how soft the corners are playing, more specifically Trey Flowers, where I think I was telling Dave it was at 3rd and 6, 3rd and 7, somewhere around there, 3rd down, and it looked like Trey was giving the guy about a 10 to 12 yard cushion when all he needed was 6 or 7 for a 1st down. And you're looking at that, and they converted, and he comes up and makes a tackle, and you're going, I don't even understand that. I know you don't want to get beat deep, but is that the coaches telling him to do that because they just don't trust his ability to keep it in front of him, so they'll just give up the 1st down? Or what do you think's happening there?
Well, I mean, I don't know the specific play. I mean, there's obviously a lot that can go into that, and that could be dependent on the formation, the receivers. Does he have help underneath? There were a few times where they actually ran a kind of a zone blitz where they brought someone off the corner, and then they were having one of the safeties was supposed to be underneath the outside receiver, and the other safety was over the top. But look, Trey, for whatever reason, he's not jamming really anymore. He's opening up his hips and he's running out, usually with a snap, or he's bailing out quick. And it might be, again, one of those where they say, hey, look, you're right, from the 20s to the 20, we're going to force them to travel a long way. And then we'll tighten it up when we get inside the red zone. That could be it. But I can't address a play because I'm not 100% sure of it. I will.
It's more than one play, Paul. Forward. Say that. It just seems to be how he's playing.
Because, again, I'm always hesitant, because in this defense right now, I watched last week, there's times I'm not sure what they're doing. There's times I go, well, I'm not sure who's got that deep crossing route. And some of the linebackers are looking at each other. And there's other times, you know, the old days of what we used to play, you know, you crowded receivers. They do a lot of spot dropping. I don't think that works very well in this league, particularly if the ball doesn't come out quick. So there's a bunch of head scratching moments. There's times where there's just flat busts. We saw, you know, Griffin have one on the goal line. They're out there. They've got to clean all of that stuff up. But the answer to your question, very long-winded in this whole defense, is I think they are telling them, look, we're okay with you giving up some things underneath. We'll rally to that, and we'll live to play the next down.
You know, going into the game, I thought deep crossers. That's my concern. That's what I would like them to do. Jordan Brooks picked it up,
yes, man,
turned and ran.
Yes.
But then we saw later it didn't happen, and it ended up being the longest play of the game. And then, but, you know, that's what I thought last week. This week, Paul, I would say you got to be physical. This is a game, and, you know, and we've seen them sometimes play a little bit softer at the line of scrimmage. I feel like this is a game where you're going to have to come up and punch these guys in the mouth with their run game.
it's a tough running game. You know, just the way they pull their guards, some of the traps, you know, some of the fly sweeps. It's a very sophisticated running game. And a really sophisticated running game is more complicated than stopping the passing game. It's just there's so many moving parts, you know, within that line of scrimmage. And this is one of those. The Rams are the same thing. They give you a very tough week of preparing. You know, Dave, that one play you were talking about, and you're right. I think we have to be really physical. We have to absolutely say we're stopping the run and let Jimmy G try to beat us, and we crowd everything inside the numbers. You guys heard me for the last couple of years. You have to force him to throw the ball outside the numbers. He's not that he can't make a throw, but he can't consistently make that throw. He's not comfortable making that throw. They've lost all of their speed at wide receiver. They really don't have any. You know, Kittle is the main guy that you've got to take away on this. But I was just going back to that one play you were talking about, their longest play, Dave. And honestly, I wasn't sure who was supposed to pick that guy up. Yeah. There was a lot of people looking at each other. And that's where I go, wow, there's confusion with Bobby. And, you know, Brooks, like, if he messes one up, I get it. But I thought he looked people up. I thought he had great pattern recognition. I thought his improvement from the first time on the field this year to what we saw last week is a huge leap. I'm actually excited to watch this guy play moving forward. And I now see why they drafted him. The speed and size of this guy, he has a chance to be a really good player.
Yeah, the other thing I thought too, Paul, is watching him at college, I mean, at least the stuff we saw, and I saw full games, not a lot of zone drops for him. I mean, no. It was more man-to-man and spy, and it just seems like he really gets it, and especially coming off an injury, you know, where he had missed a game or two. That was, yeah, I just thought the word I've been using is promising. You know, like Quentin Dunbar. I mean, you can't say a lot that's great about this defense, but there's some things I think that are promising.
Yeah, it keeps coming down to there's just the mistakes. You know, it's just play the defense the way it's designed, have good communication with each other. If they clean just that up, because there are times you're watching it and you're going, okay, that's pretty good. That was pressure from the defensive line. Ah, you know what? We again, the longer plays develop, if you play in zone all the time, there are going to be receivers open. That's a given. You can't cover everybody in the zone. There's just not enough guys. So there's times I'm going, oh, well, that's good. That's good. Ah, Murray got out of it. Well, you know, they busted coverage there. And again, all it has to happen is every once in a while, and it continues to, you know, push the drives along. And, you know, I go through this whole game. We didn't even play that poorly. We just, the key downs, the impact downs were the one where they've got a third down and eight or five, actually, I think. And they called an unnecessary roughness on Bobby Wagner, which, again, whatever, you know, it is what it is. We line up improperly on a field goal. I just those two plays, we win the football game. And there are more of those. Their first touchdown drive, we're off the field. And again, we get a bad call and a blown coverage. And next thing you know, they score a touchdown. So I see where Pete's going, our best is yet to come, because I think he's looking at this going, okay, we have athletes, we have players. We're just busting too much. And I don't know if that's the scheme. I don't know if that's just guys not having enough practice time together. But, you know, they've got to right the ship here before the last four games of the season, or this is just going to be a nice season. You're not going to finish it in the playoffs.
Paul, how much do you think Carlos Dunlap and Snacks Harrison are going to help him?
Well, I think Dunlap for sure. I mean, we just need help on the other side of Maioa. There's just no question there. We're not getting really any productivity there. So just a seasoned guy who can play, you know, a bunch of different ways in the pass rush, and he's pretty good in the run defense too. So I think there's a guy who's an immediate improvement. Snacks, I just don't know yet. You know, I haven't seen him live. I haven't seen if he's in shape. If he's in shape and is ready to go, it's more depth. We can do a lot more things with it. And again, the next few weeks, we got the Rams, we've got the 49ers, and even Arizona again. You know, the running game is critical, particularly up the middle.
Paul, we look forward to it every week. We appreciate it, my friend. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, you guys. Thanks. Appreciate it. Have me on.
There you go. There's Paul Moyer. I should try to say week one more time. Somehow I squeezed three of them in there. All right, coming up, we'll hear from Jamal Adams, Richard Sherman, and Stephen A. Smith when we sweep the dial. Next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore. Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
But I'm glad it happened, bro. We needed it. As crazy as it sounds. Bro, I'm glad it happened. I was so excited to see how the building, you know, is when we lose, you know, because I'm new, so I've seen all the winning, so now I see how people react of losing. At the end of the day, that just helps me as a leader, as one of the leaders on the team, to know who can take criticism and how to come at them in certain ways, just so they can perform better. Like there's nothing personal. When it comes to anybody that's holding somebody accountable, that's not personal. That's what it's about, bro, just getting on the same page and understanding your teammates because, you know, we in this together, bro.
That's the voice of Jamal Adams from the 17 Weeks Uninterrupted podcast that he's doing this season. That's turning a negative into a positive right there, isn't it, Jim? I mean, boy, you're talking about making lemonade out of lemons. He's looking at that saying, hey, I'm glad we lost. Now we can see how we can help people, and, you know, him being a leader, he knows what buttons to push with people after a tough game. So I guess for him it's not as jarring because he was coming from the New York Jets, who were used to losing week in, week out. So this feels great. 5-1, one loss, not a big deal.
Yeah, I love hearing this from him every week, the uninterrupted podcast that he has, and he's such an outspoken, well-spoken kid and already a team leader. And he's only played three games so far. And you think about the future with this guy, already the best player on that defense. And hopefully he can come back this week. But you're right, with the Jets, I think it was more about, I mean, there's a big difference between finger pointing and holding people accountable. And I think that's what's happening here is the accountable part of it and not the finger pointing, you know, except for us in the media, of course. But no, not in that locker room. And Jamal Adams has a new perspective, and I think it's going to help the Seahawks.
It's one of those things. It's unspoken. If you're in Tampa and somebody hits Tom Brady like that, I don't think that guy makes it off the field. If you're in Seattle and that happens to Russell Wilson, I don't think that guy makes it off the field. If you're in New Orleans and it happens to Drew, that guy does not make it off the field. That's how football goes. Now, what the league has to say about it, the league picks and chooses what they want to be aggressive with and what they want to, hey, you can't say that. And I highly doubt they'll say, because that's almost an unspoken truth in our game. You hit the quarterback, you cheap shot him, the team defends him. That's what you do. It happens on the sideline. If somebody cheap shots him on their sideline, you see that guy get roughed up and then gets back on the field. And you don't ever hear about any punishment or anything happening because that's just how it goes. But I think there's something to be said about the leadership of Mike McCarthy and the way his team is responding in general to adversity.
That's the voice of Richard Sherman joining Chris Collinsworth's podcast and spoke about the Cowboys not defending Andy Dalton after Jonathan Bostic hit him with the cheap shot. Said it speaks to Mike McCarthy's leadership. Now, I saw a quote from Mike McCarthy sort of taking issue with his team, Jim, that, you know, hey.
He wasn't happy about it.
Yeah, I can't remember what he said, but just paraphrasing, like, expected more of him. And there were others that were calling out those guys for just kind of meandering around, looking at him, helping. I mean, there was no intensity to anything. And I know Dave doesn't think it was a dirty hit. I've watched it a few times. He had given himself up. He was sliding. And that guy came flying.
Bob, did you think it was clear cut, though, that it was a cheap shot?
It looked pretty cheap to me.
Yeah.
He was giving himself up. He's sliding.
It was on the cheap shot side of things. I don't think it was clear cut, though.
Yeah. Well, we'll agree to disagree, I guess. But even in an instance where it is sort of a bang-bang play and there is gray area, you see guys at minimum, there'll be some pushing and shoving and jawing back and forth and some level of, hey, man, you're not going to do that to my quarterback. They did none of that. That was gone now. Whether that's a result of Mike McCarthy or guys that have just given up and don't care about the season, there's not the camaraderie. I don't know what it is, but it's a bad look.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you're Andy Dalton, would you be disappointed in not having any kind of reaction there?
Yes, I would.
Yeah. Well, and he's the backup guy coming in there, too, and I just feel bad for Andy Dalton.
Do you think they would have responded differently if that were Dak Prescott?
Well, that's a good question. Perhaps. But it should be the same no matter who the quarterback is, no matter if you're the best quarterback in the league or the worst, and everything in between. You should be supporting him. I think Sherman's right, although, you know, Richard never seemed like the biggest supporter of Russell's when he was here in Seattle and has gone out of his way to be critical, it seems, at times anyway, of Russell since he went to San Francisco. But I'm sure the offensive lineman would have stuck up for Russell if he'd been hit like that.
In my vantage point, I think, is that he went into the game, he played the first seven innings. At that particular moment in time, he was informed.
Correct.
That the
That's the information.
So guess what? In my vantage point, as a 12-year veteran in Major League Baseball, 7 years with the Los Angeles Dodgers, I've been around these dudes not just yesterday, not just the day before, not just the week before, but that night for the first 7 innings. We've been in the dugout, we've been playing and stuff like that, and I'm 2 innings away from winning a World Series championship. You know what? You told me I can't play, all right? I'm not playing. But to me, I'm going to put on a mask, and even if I have to engage in social distancing while doing so, I'm going to be on that field receiving that adulation, those applause and everything like that. I'm going to do that.
Stephen A. Smith talking about Justin Turner's decision to celebrate with his team after being pulled from the game when it was found out that he had tested positive for COVID-19. He was out there afterwards celebrating. Some pictures of him with a mask, many without, walking around without the mask. And to me, I thought it was wildly irresponsible. I get the desire to be out there. Of course, your team just won a World Series. I absolutely understand that. But, you know, baseball has come out and everybody else has come out saying basically he just said, well, bleep this, I'm going out there to celebrate. To me, you got to think of your teammates in that situation. Yes, you were around them. But maybe that extra exposure just creates that element that wasn't there before.
Well, do you think he should have been forcibly stopped?
I think somebody should have said, Justin, hey, man, we get it, but you can't do it. It just Everybody's been following this protocol. They've been following it to a T. I understand there's no season left, but you're still looking at a potential of infecting a teammate. Maybe you didn't infect otherwise. Who's got a family member that all of a sudden you're finding out has got some health concerns, or maybe it's their parents, or I think you've got to think about somebody other than yourself in that situation. Again, I completely understand his excitement and wanting to be out there and his teammates wanting him to be there, but you've got to be more considerate in that situation and understanding maybe you don't know everybody's situation with their parents or their family members or their loved ones, and somebody might be compromised in terms of their health, and you're then putting them at risk.
Okay, Bob, help me out here. Didn't he find out in the second inning?
I don't know. I read
it. It seemed like that's what I read too. That a second inning, and yet he played seven innings.
Well, I think they were saying that the test came back in the second. I don't know if he got informed right away. I don't know how that went down because I've seen some articles that sort of counter the other. So I don't know which is true. To be honest,
It just seems fishy a little bit to me that they were behind 1-0 in the second inning, and then after they get the lead, then he leaves the game. And now if they've been behind, would he have still been out there playing if the game had gone extra innings?
Are you saying there were shenanigans going on there?
Well, yeah. I mean, my mind's working that way.
The Dodgers have some pull with the league and said, hey, okay, yeah, he's tested positive, but he might come up with a big hit here. Can we leave him in for a few more innings or at least till we get the lead?
Yeah. Yeah, it occurred to me, especially if you find out in the second inning and you play five more innings.
Yeah, I've seen articles that speak to the contrary, and I don't know which is true. I mean, none of us were there, so I'm reading one that says one thing, one that says the polar opposite. Maybe the truth is somewhere in between. He knew in the fifth. I don't know. I've got no idea. But I thought that was kind of weak, personally.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And you're right. It wasn't like he was socially distancing when he was out there, and you saw him with the mask and kissing his wife or girlfriend, whoever she was. And yeah, not a good look.
Yeah. All right. Coming up, it's time for our player spotlight. We'll speak with Seahawks kicker Jason Myers. He's going to join us next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.